Friday edition of The Drive is underway. I'm Jack Sunday, The Drive with Jack Sunday at KFGO. And every once in a while, we like to bring Troy Larson in. He's a co-worker here at KFGO, the author of So Many Secrets, which is available online. I just Google Troy Larson, So Many Secrets, and there hasn't been a chapter lately, but are you still working on that?
Yep, I am still working on it. We'll have another chapter coming sometime soon here. I think about another of my uncles who turned up dead under mysterious circumstances. So,
now, just for a second here, because we want to talk about another genealogical DNA. Well, another story about genealogical DNA, but it's a first of its kind. But can you give us a real thumbnail about what So Many Secrets is about?
So Many Secrets is my blog about my unusual family background. My grandpa, my biological grandpa, was taken to jail for beating my grandma, and he committed suicide in jail. I have an uncle who was in prison for 33 and a third years. I have an aunt that nobody ever knew about. Lots of weird, strange revelations in my family. So that's what I've been writing about.
It is a very good read, and it's excellently written. So Many Secrets, Troy Larson, available online. What is the website it's on, though?
It's sonictremormedia.com.
I have such a hard time remembering that. I'll work on it. But another thing we talk about frequently here with Troy, and thank you for your interest, because you and I get a chance to chat in the halls now and again about these things, but this genealogical DNA. Mm-hmm. Again, tell our listeners and me again what this is.
This is a new tactic for analyzing DNA evidence and finding perpetrators where previously law enforcement had no suspects. So what they do is they'll recover DNA from a crime scene. They'll upload that DNA profile to like a family tree website, something like Ancestry or 23andMe. Those aren't the sites they use, but sites like that. And they'll find a common ancestor between the perpetrator and someone else. And then once they find that common ancestor, they build family trees from that person until they find someone in a family tree who fits the description of their perpetrator. Lived in the right place at the right time, was the right race, had the right color hair, color eyes, that type of thing. And they find perpetrators where previously they had no suspects.
They have rapists and murderers behind bars. And I don't know if this genealogical DNA has been tested in court yet.
Actually, the very first case is underway right now in Idaho, if I'm not mistaken, which is where a lot of genealogical DNA stuff has been going on. But I think it's just jury selection at this point. I don't think the actual trial has started yet.
The latest story having to do with genealogical DNA, and it is unique in that, well, duh, it's the first of its kind. There can never be another first of its kind. That's a redundancy, as a matter of fact. And this is a case out of Idaho as well. Mm-hmm. This is the Christopher Tapp story, 43 years old, who has been in prison for
20 years
of a 30-year sentence.
Yep.
And this particular case was, you were telling me, after I forwarded this story to you, the basis of a TV series or a documentary?
Yep. Yep, there was a show on Starz, which is a pay channel, called The Wrong Man, and it highlighted several different false confession stories, guys who confessed to doing things that they didn't actually do, and Christopher Tapp's case was the subject of one of those episodes.
Do you remember why he made that confession? Did he claim it was under duress? Was he just tired of talking? Or why am I giving you multiple choice?
Yeah, all of the above. You know, every time you see one of these cases where somebody falsely confessed, where they were later proven to have falsely confessed, it's always for the same reason. It's because they have faith in the justice system, and they go, well, I didn't do anything, so nothing bad is going to happen to me. I'm just going to help out the police. It's because sometimes because they're undereducated. A lot of times they're underprivileged. They don't have anybody to help them. They don't recognize that moment where the police cross the line from asking you for help to you're our suspect. And frequently, almost all the time in every one of these cases, they are coercive leading questions that they ask in these interrogations. Christopher Tapp had 9 police interrogations where they would ask him something and he would get it wrong. And they would say, OK, we're going to do this again tomorrow. And they would bring him back tomorrow and they would ask him those same questions again. And it would be a situation where the previous day they gave him the answer to that question. So then when they questioned him again the next day, he would give the correct answer. But when you review all the tapes in total, you go, oh, well, he didn't offer any information of his own. He only offered the information that they gave him.
He was given. This fella's very young. He's so at age 23, convicted of a rape of a woman named Angie Dodge back in Idaho and was sentenced to 30 years. And now what has transpired in those 20 years is, I'm sure other people have tried to help him, but what's really happened is genealogical DNA.
That's right. He applied for post-conviction relief 5 different times, even after it was clear that he was not the perpetrator. They found DNA at the crime scene that did not match him. And so when they found that, he thought, oh, this is it. I'm going to get out now. And they went, no, just because the DNA doesn't match you, all that means is someone else helped you. And we found that person's DNA. So they kept him in prison, even though they found someone else's DNA at the crime scene. And then finally, one of the very interesting angles about Chris Tapp's story is Angie Dodge, the victim, her mother, on the day that Chris Tapp was convicted, was outside the courtroom. I should say after the day he was sentenced, she was outside the courtroom and she was livid that he had not gotten the death penalty. She wanted him to get the death penalty for what he did to her daughter. Within 5 years, she had completely flipped and was convinced that Chris Tapp did not kill her daughter. And she became the leading crusader to get him out of prison. And one of the ways she encouraged the authorities to get Chris Tapp out of prison was by encouraging them to pursue genealogical DNA investigation line. And they did that. And when they started investigating, they found the actual perpetrator, a suspect who had lived right across the street from Angie Dodge. And eventually, Chris Tapp, they dropped the charges against him. I should say reduced his conviction to time served, let him out of prison in 2017. And then yesterday, they officially, legally exonerated him, so he is no longer a convict. And the man who actually did it was arrested in May of this year and is now going to undergo trial.
The most famous murderer taken in as a result of genealogical DNA, of course, would have to be the Golden State Killer, of which was, that's pretty recently, too, that's come down, isn't it?
Yep, that was just in the last couple years.
Mm-hmm. And any word on any others, by the way?
Oh, there are so many. Every day there is another case coming out about genealogical DNA. You mentioned the case about Firth, Idaho, that happened when you were out there, and that one is a prime candidate for genealogical DNA investigation.
It certainly is, and I hope it is. The year before I moved away from Idaho, there were 5 murders in 3 separate cases. 5 people died. One of them was the case of 2 young boys who were wandering around in a River Bottoms Park, which is now named after my father. It was back in 1988. All of us, spent a lot of our youth in the Firth River Bottoms. They ran for mile after mile after mile. We're about 2 miles from the river to the end of the woods. And mm-hmm. We fought the Vietnam War, played cowboys down there. We made dugouts. We had a heck of a youth down there. And these boys, I remember it. I was a newsman at the time, as a matter of fact, showed up shot to death down there. Their names were the Annettes, A-N-E-T-T-S, and there were talks about the dad, and there was talks about this and that. And I remember an odd guy I ran into down in the river bottoms when I was about 18 years old who had a gun and told us to get the hell out. Well, it's not his river bottoms, but we left.
Right.
And I remember there was an odd guy that used to be a ditch runner who lived down there who was very in a small cabin in the woods near the head gates of a canal system, mm-hmm. While they irrigate out there. And he was kind of an odd duck. But that was even before 1988. And the only reason I remember those is because the police is putting out a call. And they're asking people, do you remember the scrutiny that the family faced? Did any family members say something? Do you remember anybody that the Annette boys are having trouble with? They were real young. I can't even remember how that. I mean, I think they were 12 or 13 years old or something like this. And they don't think it was just a random murder. And this information came out from the Bingham County Sheriff's Department. And there are people who know them. Mm-hmm. And I hope they find the perpetrator because it's been since 1988.
Yeah,
and that is a prime place for it because they're big into genealogy out there.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, any of those cases, and really any case that's unsolved or where the perpetrator has not been caught, if DNA was recovered from any of the victims, if you're a family member or a loved one or a friend of the person who was the victim, those families and those friends need to be screaming to the authorities to retest the DNA evidence that was recovered at the crime scene and investigate through genealogical DNA, because it really has the potential. If they recover DNA, it really has the potential to break decades-old cases wide open. There was a case from Seattle just a couple weeks ago that I read about going back to 1963. They caught a guy. This is the oldest yet genetic genealogy case that they've used it to crack the case. So absolutely, if I were in a family where one of my loved ones turned up dead and they recovered DNA, I would be going to the media. I would be screaming in the press about, hey, they have DNA. What are they doing to investigate this case and bring this person to justice?
Another question comes up is, why do I always call it genealogy? And I think the right word is genealogy. How did I learn that? But it's genetics, so why, you know? So
yeah, and you know, you bring that up. I was going to say that this field of investigation that we're talking about goes by so many different names now. Some people are calling it family tree DNA. Some people are calling it genetic genealogy, genealogical DNA investigation. They're all the same thing, basically using a family tree to discover who your perpetrator is.
GDNA would suit me fine, and I wouldn't have to embarrass myself for decades more, I'm sure. Well, true crime aficionado, good friend, author, co-worker here at KFGO, Troy Larson, thank you for joining us again today. I hope our listeners are as interested in this kind of stuff as we are, but if not, it's been a great 10 minutes. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Jack.
Troy Larson with us here on The Drive with Jack Sunday on 790 KFGO.